This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Podcast of audio reading service volunteers reading the Journal Gazette is provided by the Allen County Public Library for the sight and print impaired and made available with the permission and cooperation of the Journal Gazette.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Mitch with
Shelley.
And for the next 2 hours, we'll be reading selections from the Wednesday, November 19th, Fort Wayne Journal Gazette, copyright 2025. We'll begin with the with news for the first hour and then take a short break. When we come back from the break, we'll read obituaries, then a number of features from the living section. And after that, we'll read from the perspective sections, including letters to the editor and editorials. After editorials, we'll read the TV listings, sports, and birthday announcements. The headlines from the front page of the November 19th, 2025 Journal Gazette are: Congress votes to release Epstein files. City Council elects Paddock president. Federal judge blocks Texas from using map. And Trump defends Saudis over Khashoggi slaying. Now here's Shelley with the first article.
Congress votes to release Epstein files. Lawmakers nearly unanimous in demanding documents, from the Associated Press, Washington. Both the House and Senate acted decisively Tuesday to pass a bill to force the Justice Department to publicly release its files on the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, a remarkable display of approval for effort that had struggled for months to overcome opposition from President Donald Trump and Republican leadership. When a small bipartisan group of House lawmakers introduced a petition in July to maneuver around Speaker Mike Johnson's control of the House floor, it appeared a long-shot effort, especially as Trump urged his supporters to dismiss the matter as a hoax. But both Trump and Johnson failed to prevent the vote. The president in recent days bowed to political reality, saying he would sign the bill. And just hours after the House vote, senators agreed to approve it unanimously, skipping a formal roll call. The decisive bipartisan work in Congress on Tuesday further showed the pressure mounting on lawmakers and the Trump administration to meet long-held demands that the Justice Department release its case files on Epstein, a well-connected financier who killed himself in a Manhattan jail while awaiting trial in 2019 on charges he sexually abused and trafficked underage girls. For survivors of the Epstein abuse, passage of the bill was a watershed moment in a years-long quest for accountability. These women have fought the most horrific fight that no woman should have to fight, and they did it by banding together and never giving up, said Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene as she stood with some of the abuse survivors outside the Capitol Tuesday morning. That's what we did by fighting so hard against the most powerful people in the world, even the President of the United States, in order to make this vote happen today, asked Greene, a Georgian Republican. In the end, only one lawmaker in Congress opposed the bill. Republican Clay Higgins, a Louisiana Republican who is a fervent supporter of Trump, was the only nay vote in the House's 427-1 tally. He said he worried that the legislation could lead to the release of information on innocent people mentioned in the federal investigation. The bill forces the release within 30 days of all files and communications related to Epstein, as well as any information about the investigation into his death in federal prison. It would allow the Justice Department to redact information about Epstein's victims or continuing federal investigations, but not information due to embarrassment, reputational harm, or political sensitivity. Even before the bill's passage Tuesday, thousands of pages of emails and other documents from Epstein's estate have been released from an investigation by the House Oversight Committee. Those documents show Epstein's connections to global leaders, Wall Street power brokers, influential political figures, and Trump himself. In the United Kingdom, King Charles III stripped his disgraced brother, Prince Andrew, of his remaining titles and evicted him from his royal residence after pressure to act over his relationship with Epstein. Johnson kept the House closed for legislative business for nearly 2 months and refused to swear in Democrat Republican Adelita Grijalva of Arizona during the government shutdown. After winning a special election on September 23rd, Grijalva had pledged to provide the crucial 218th vote to petition for the Epstein Files bill. But only after she was sworn into office last week could she sign her name to discharge petition to give it the majority vote in the 435-member House. It became obvious the bill would pass, and both Johnson and Trump began to fold. Trump on Sunday said the Republicans should vote for the bill.
Okay. City Council elects Paddock president. Republican Yale steps down, touts Democrat to serve for rest of year. This is from Devin Filchik of the Journal Gazette. A Republican Fort Wayne City Council member reached across the political aisle when determining who would serve as president the rest of the year. Councilman Russ Yale, Republican of the 2nd, resigned from council's top leadership role Tuesday and nominated Councilman Jeff Paddock, Democrat of the 5th, to serve as president. Yale said he is unable to run some meetings, a top duty of the president's, because of work-related travel. Yale and Paddock are currently the longest-standing members on the council. Jeff and I started on council together 14 years ago, and he is the right person with the right experience at the right time to finish out the year and lead the Fort Wayne City Council, Yale said. Jeff is a statesman and unifier. The nomination was approved unanimously. Councilman Scott Myers, the Republican of the 4th, was absent. Councilwoman Rolly Booker, Democrat of the 6th, applauded Paddock's rise in leadership, but said the nomination seemed like an empty symbolic gesture. In January, she nominated Paddock for this year's vice president, and that was not supported by Republican members. A true show, again, of bipartisanship would have been to have him serve the entire year, not for 2 months at the end of this year, she said. The council's last meeting of the year is December 16th. City Clerk Lena Kiesling said. The council typically meets 4 times a month. Paddock said he appreciates the gesture. I'll certainly do my best over the next 2 months, approximately 7 weeks, to make all of you proud, conduct business properly, and to continue to serve this wonderful city that I love, he said. Yale said he expects Council Vice President Marty Bender, Republican at large, to serve as president next year, starting with the first meeting January 6th. City council presidents have typically held the post for 1 year before the vice president is voted into the top position the next year and takes over. The timing provided a unique bipartisan opportunity that the partisan nature of politics would not normally afford, Yale said in an email Tuesday night. It's rare for the Republican-dominated council to have a Democrat serve as president. Former Councilman Glenn Hines, a Democrat, served as president in 2023 following a year-long stint as former Councilman Jason Arp's vice president. Hines was an at-large member after years of representing Southeast Fort Wayne. Arp, a Republican, worked with the council's 4 Democrats to get the council's top position. In exchange, he nominated and supported Hines as his vice president. Hines had advocated for bipartisan leadership for council. When he was elected president, Republican Councilman Todd Freistrafer served as vice president. Bipartisan leadership ended the following year when Yale was elected as Freistrafer's vice president. The odds of Democrats gaining those top leadership positions are slimmer now than in 2023 when council members' parties were split 5-4. Democrats now hold 3 of 9 seats on council, so they would have to convince 2 Republicans to vote with them to be successful. Paddock has not previously served in either top role, and he didn't expect to with Republicans holding the majority, he said. The councilman said he thinks dependability is a factor. Paddock said he has missed only one council meeting in 14 years. He and Bender are the only council members with perfect attendance this year. Yale has missed 7 meetings this year, including 6 committee sessions. He expects to miss 2 more meetings this year when he's out of town with the travel business he and his wife own, he said in an email.
Federal judges block Texas from using MAP. Vote 2-1, the proposal hurts minority voters, governor vows appeal, from the Associated Press. A federal court Tuesday blocked Texas from using a redrawn U.S. House map that touched off a nationwide redistricting battle and is a major piece of President Donald Trump's efforts to preserve a slim majority, Republican majority ahead of the 2026 elections. The ruling is a blow to Trump's rush to create a more favorable political landscape for Republicans in next year's midterms, at least for now. Texas Governor Greg Abbott vowed a swift appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court and defended the map that was engineered to give Republicans 5 additional House seats. But in a 2-1 ruling, a panel of federal judges in El Paso sided with opponents who argued that Texas's unusual summer redrawing of congressional districts would harm Black and Hispanic residents. The decision was written by U.S. District Judge Jeffrey W. Brown, who was nominated to the bench by Trump during his first term. The public perception of this case is that it's about politics. To be sure, politics played a role in drawing the 2025 map, but it was much more than just politics. Substantial evidence shows that Texas racially gerrymandered the 2025 map, the ruling states. The decision comes amid a widening national battle over redistricting. Missouri and North Carolina followed Texas, with new maps adding an additional Republican seat each. To counter these moves, California voters approved a ballot initiative to give Democrats an additional 5 seats there. The Trump administration has filed a federal lawsuit hoping to block that map, with Attorney General Pam Bondi calling it a brazen power grab and an effort to entrench one-party rule. In a post on X, California Democrat Governor Gavin Newsom celebrated the Texas ruling. Donald Trump and Greg Abbott played with fire, got burned, and democracy won. Republicans in Texas insisted that they drew the new map only for partisan advantage. Texas' map was drawn the right way for the right reasons, Bondi posted on X. We look forward to Texas's victory at the Supreme Court. A coalition of civil rights groups representing Black and Hispanic voters argued the map reduced the influence of minority voters, making it a racial gerrymander that violates the Federal Voting Rights Act and the U.S. Constitution.
Trump defends Saudi over Khashoggi slaying. This comes from the Associated Press, Dateline Washington. President Donald Trump on Tuesday dismissed U.S. intelligence findings that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman likely had some culpability in the 2018 killing of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi, as Trump warmly welcomed the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia in his first White House visit in 7 years. The U.S.-Saudi relationship had, for a time, been sent into a tailspin by the operation targeting Khashoggi, a fierce critic of the kingdom. But 7 years later, the dark clouds over the relationship had been cleared away, and Trump is tightening his embrace of the 40-year-old crown prince, who he said is an indispensable player in shaping the Middle East in decades to come. Trump, in his defense of the crown prince, derided Khashoggi as, quote, extremely controversial, and said, quote, a lot of people didn't like that gentleman. Prince Mohammed denies involvement in the killing of Khashoggi, who was a Saudi citizen and Virginia resident. Whether you like him or not, or whether you like him or didn't like him, things happen, Trump said of the international incident when asked about it by a reporter during an Oval Office appearance with Prince Mohammed. But Prince Mohammed knew nothing about it, and we can leave it at that. You don't have to embarrass our guests by asking a question like that. But U.S. intelligence officials determined that the Saudi crown prince likely approved the killing by Saudi agents of U.S.-based journalists inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, according to U.S. findings declassified in 2021 at the start of the Biden administration. Trump officials, during his first administration, refused to release the report. Prince Mohammed said Saudi Arabia, quote, did all the right steps to investigate Khashoggi's death. It's painful and it's a huge mistake, he said. Trump, who said the two leaders have become good friends, even commended the Saudi leader for strides made by the kingdom on human rights without providing any specific detail. What he's done is incredible in terms of human rights and everything else, Trump said. President Joe Biden labeled the oil-rich kingdom a pariah state in the early days of his successful 2020 White House run. After taking office, his administration made clear the president would avoid direct engagement with the crown prince. But eventually, Biden determined that freezing out the Saudis was not tenable as oil prices spiked after Russia's February 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Biden even paid a visit to Prince Mohammed in Jeddah in July 2022 of that year to urge the prince and his fellow members of the OPEC oil cartel to pump more oil to alleviate high gas prices. The crown prince, for his part, announced Saudi Arabia was increasing its planned investment to in the United States to $1 trillion, up from $600 billion that the Saudis announced they would pour into the U.S. in May.
Southwest Allen County Schools ties turf field selection to tax loss. Long-term benefits seen in Summit Project. Ashley Sloboda from the Journal Gazette article. Anticipated property tax losses associated with a new state law factored into Southwest Allen County Schools' decision Tuesday to spend $1.2 million on a synthetic turf field instead of $800,000 on the natural grass option. The school board's approval came about 2 months after hiring Context Design as the architectural firm for the Summit Middle School track and field project. Officials plan to pause the design process at 35% completion to give the district updated pricing and an operational cost analysis for grass and synthetic turf options. The existing field has surface deterioration and drainage concerns that have increasingly limited its use. Summit's project fall enrollment was about 750 students. The most impactful difference between natural grass and synthetic turf is just the dramatic increase of availability and reliability of the field throughout the year, said Randy Libby, the district's chief operating officer. She provided further details in the board packet, noting a grass field typically supports 4 to 6 hours of weekly activity before the surface begins to deteriorate or require recovery time. Weather, standing water, and seasonal wear can further limit usage. A synthetic turf can support at least 30 hours of weekly use without surface damage concerns or the need for rest periods. This would provide more opportunities for activities, including physical education classes, football, soccer, and track, to share the facility without displacing one another or moving indoors, Libby wrote. For Summit, this level of availability greatly improves scheduling flexibility and ensures a year-round dependable access for students, she said. Libby acknowledged synthetic turf carries a higher initial cost, but told the board its annual maintenance is estimated at $2,000, substantially less than the $20,000 or more required for grass. Natural fields require mowing, irrigation, grass repairs, lawn treatments, and painting the playing field. With the operations funds reductions beginning in 2026 under the State Enrolled Act No. 1, the long-term cost avoidance is a meaningful factor, Libby said, referring to the property tax reform law state legislators passed this year. Governor Mike Braun has touted the bill as historic property tax relief. Starting next year, Southwest Allen County Schools expects to lose about $3.5 million from its $17 million operations fund levy based on the new legislation combined with current property tax caps, Libby said. That estimated loss is up from about $2 million this year and nearly $900,000 last year. The operations fund is part of the budget that generally pays for items not directly tied to instruction, including district-level services and utilities. It's primarily supported by local property taxes. The district's debt fund can support the one-time capital investment for synthetic turf, Libby said.
Poland says two Ukrainians tied to Russia suspected in a rail blast. This is from the Associated Press, Dateline, Warsaw, Poland. Two Ukrainian citizens working for Russia are suspected of blowing up a railway line in Poland over the weekend, Prime Minister Donald Tusk said Tuesday. Speaking to the Sejm, the lower house of the Polish parliament, Tusk said that the two suspects had been collaborating with the Russian secret services for a long time. He said their identities were known but could not be revealed due to the public because of ongoing investigations. The pair have already left Poland, exiting via the Tiraspol border, crossing to Belarus, he said. Tusk has described the weekend explosion on a rail line linking Poland's capital Warsaw to the border with Ukraine as an unprecedented act of sabotage. In a separate incident, which Polish officials also now confirm as sabotage, power lines over another segment of the same rail line further south were also damaged. When asked to comment on Polish statements saying that two Ukrainian nationals working for Russia had sabotaged a railway line, presidential spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said it would be, quote, strange if Russia wasn't blamed first. Russia is accused of all forms of hybrid and direct warfare taking place in Poland, Peskov told Russian media Tuesday. In this regard, Russophobia is, of course, in full bloom. Western officials have accused Russia and its proxies of staging dozens of attacks and other incidents across Europe since the invasion of Ukraine more than 3 years ago, according to data collected by the AP. Moscow's goal, Western officials say, is to undermine support for Ukraine, spark fear, and divide European societies. A meeting of the Governmental National Security Committee took place in Warsaw earlier Tuesday with the participation of military commanders, heads of intelligence services, and a representative of the president. Army patrols have been sent to check the safety of the railways and other key infrastructure in the east of the country, the defense minister said. Polish prosecutors have initiated an investigation into, quote, acts of sabotage of a terrorist nature directed against railway infrastructure and committed for the benefit of foreign intelligence. These actions brought about an immediate danger of a land traffic disaster, threatening the lives and health of many people and property on a large scale, prosecutors said in a statement. In the first incident, an explosion damaged the tracks near the village of Mika, about 60 miles southeast of Warsaw. In a separate incident, power lines were destroyed in the area of Polavy, about 30 miles from Lublin. Trains carrying passengers were forced to stop at both locations, but no one was hurt. The explosion was most likely intended to blow up the train, Tusk said on Monday in reference to the Mika incident. The damage caused at both locations has been repaired.
Coroner IDs man, 77, as victim in house fire, from the Journal Gazette. The Allen County Coroner's Office Tuesday identified the man who died in a house fire on Reed Street in Fort Wayne. Willie L. Williams, 77, of Fort Wayne, died on November 11th of smoke inhalation and thermal burns, according to news release Tuesday. The manner of death was ruled accidental. Crews were called to the 3017 Reed Street on the city's southwest side at 1:28 a.m. November 11th and arrived 4 minutes later. The fire was under control at 2:25 a.m. according to previously released information. The man was taken out of the home, which had heavy fire and smoke damage toward the front of the living area, but life-saving efforts were unsuccessful. Firefighters remained for several hours to make sure the fire was extinguished, fire officials have said. The fire remains under investigation by the Fort Wayne Fire Department, Fort Wayne Police Department, and Allen County Prosecutor's Office. The coroner's office has investigated at least one other fire death this year. Edward Eugene Ward, 68, died in May of smoke inhalation and thermal burns from an apartment fire in the 1200 block of Columbia Avenue.
Okay. One of 25 abducted students in Nigeria escapes safe. This is from the Associated Press, Dateline MAGA, Nigeria. A schoolgirl who was abducted with 24 others from a dormitory in northwestern Nigeria has escaped and is safe, the school's principal said Tuesday, as hunters joined security forces in the search for the missing students in forests close to the school. The girls were kidnapped before dawn on Monday when gunmen attacked the dorms at the Government Girls Comprehensive Secondary School in Kebbi State's MAGA town. Local police said the gunmen scaled the fence to enter the school premises and exchanged gunfire with police officers before seizing the girls and killing a staff member. No group has claimed responsibility for taking the girls, but analysts and locals say gangs of bandits often target schools, travelers, and remote villagers in kidnappings for ransoms. Authorities say the bandits are mostly former herders who have taken up arms against farming communities after clashes between them over strained resources. Mass school kidnappings are especially common in northern Nigeria, and the Kebbi school is close to conflict hotspots, including Zamfara and Sokoto states, where several gangs are known to operate and hide out. The students who escaped arrived home late Monday, hours after the kidnapping, according to the school principal, Musa Rabi Magaji. Another student was able to escape the gunmen in the minutes after the raid and was not abducted, the principal said. They are safe and sound, Magaji said. A video verified by AP shows the two schoolgirls who appear to be in their early teens, lost in thought and surrounded by family and other villagers with hijabs covering their heads. High schoolers in Nigeria are usually aged between 12 and 17. Security forces and hunters, meanwhile, have intensified efforts to find and rescue the others. Local officials said, security teams swept nearby forests where gangs often hide while others were deployed along major roads leading to the school. Kebbi Governor Nasir Idris visited the school on Monday and assured of efforts to rescue the girls. And Nigeria's Chief of Army Staff, Lieutenant General Wade Shaibu, met with soldiers in the hours after the attack and directed, quote, intelligence-driven operations and relentless day and night pursuit of the abductors, according to an Army statement. We must find these children, act decisively and professionally on all intelligence. Success is not optional, the Army Chief said. By Tuesday morning, the dorm and the classroom block, a walking distance apart, were deserted. In MAGA, families waiting for news of their children's freedom expressed anger and frustration. Resident Abdul Karim Abdullahi, whose daughter and granddaughter, aged 13 and 10 respectively, were among the kidnapped children, said he overheard the noise from his house. I was at home when I suddenly heard gunshots from the school. We were told that the attackers entered the school with many motorcycles, Abdullahi said. Amina Hassan, wife of the school vice principal, Hassan Yakubu Makuku, said the assailants broke into their house, which is on the school premises, and fatally shot her husband. He was also the school's chief security officer. Three of them entered and asked my husband, "Are you Malam Hassan?" And he responded, "Yes, I am." They told him that we are here to kill you, she said. At least 1,500 students have been seized in the region since Boko Haram jihadi extremists seized 276 Chibok schoolgirls over a decade ago. But bandits are also active in the region, and analysts say gangs often target schools to gain attention.
Education Department dismantling accelerates. From Colin Binkley, Associated Press, from Washington. The U.S. Education Department is handling some of its biggest grant programs to other federal agencies as the Trump administration accelerates its plan to shut down the department. The changes announced Tuesday represent a major step forward for the administration's dismantling of the department, which has mainly involved cutting jobs since President Donald Trump called for its elimination with an executive action in March. Six new agreements signed by the Education Department will effectively move billions of dollars in grant programs to other agencies. Most notable is the one that will put Department of Labor over some of the largest federally funded streams for K-12 schools, including Title I money for schools serving low-income communities. Opponents have argued against such a shakeup, saying it could disrupt programs that support some of the nation's most vulnerable student populations. States rely on the Education Department officials for expertise that other agencies might not have, says Angelica Infante Green, Rhode Island's K-12 education chief. People might think it's just funding and giving them the money, but it's not, Infante Green said in an interview. It is about how to commingle some of the funds to educate a child. So if a child is in a special education program, but it also has a multilingual learner and they're in poverty, how do you use that to educate the child holistically? Department officials said that the programs will continue to be funded at levels set by Congress. They did not say whether the changes would bring further job cuts at the department, which has been thinned by waves of mass layoffs and voluntary retirement offers. The Trump administration is taking bold action to break up the federal education bureaucracy and return education to the states, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said in a statement. Cutting through layers of red tape in Washington is one essential piece of our final mission. The action leaves in place the Education Department 1.6 trillion student loan portfolio and its funding for students with disabilities. Though McMahon has suggested both would be better managed by other federal departments, also unaffected is the department's Office for Civil Rights, which works with students and families who bring allegations of discrimination. McMahon and her staff have spent months hammering out the deals, which allow the department to lop off large parts of its footprint without action from Congress. It's being done through formal agreements that agencies often make with another when their work overlaps. The Education Department tested the idea in June with a deal that moved adult education programs to labor. The new agreements take a step further and lay the groundwork for more. Under the new plan, labor will oversee almost all grant programs that are now managed by the Education Department's offices for K-12 and higher education. Along with the $18 billion Title I program, that includes smaller funding pools for teacher training, English instruction, and TRIO, a program that helps steer low-income students to college degrees. It will effectively outsource the department's Office of Elementary and Secondary Education and Office of Post-Secondary Education, two of the agency's largest units.
State Republicans' rift on redistricting grows. This is from Tom Davies and Casey Smith of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. Indiana Governor Mike Braun on Tuesday made his most overt political threat to recalcitrant Republican state senators over early congressional redistricting, saying he'd look for ways to, quote, compel them to act and vowing to support primary challengers. Braun's rebuke came shortly after a deep divide among Senate Republicans was exposed with a typically routine vote on adjourning Tuesday's procedural Organization Day session until January. Votes in the Senate and House set January 5th as the date lawmakers will return to the State House and start the new legislative session, not on December 1st as previously planned, to take up President Donald Trump's wish for Republican-led states to draw more GOP-friendly U.S. House districts ahead of the 2026 midterm elections. The Senate's adjournment resolution was approved by a 29-19 margin. All 10 Democratic senators supported the resolution, while Republican senators split 19-19 on whether to back Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray's decision last week against meeting in December on the grounds of too little support for a congressional redistricting to pass the chamber. The Senate's action sidesteps Braun's call for a special legislative session that was to have started November 3rd, with Braun responding Tuesday that it's time now for our state senators to commit to showing up for work. Unfortunately, Senator Rod Bray was forced to partner with Democrats to block an effort by the growing number of America First senators who wanted to have a vote on passing fare maps. Now I'm left with no choice other than to explore all options at my disposal to compel the state Senate to show up and vote, Braun said in a statement. I will support President Trump's efforts to recruit, endorse, and finance primary challengers for Indiana's senators who refuse to support fair maps. Braun's office did not answer questions from the Indiana Capital Chronicle about what steps the governor could take to, quote, compel Senate action. In a statement to the Capital Chronicle, Bray downplayed the dispute. Senate Republicans may have a difference of opinion on a policy matter with the governor, and that happens from time to time, but we're committed to pursuing policies that will make life better for Hoosiers, and we will continue to look for ways to collaborate with the governor, Bray said. Redistricting supporters wanted Indiana lawmakers to craft a map with all 9 of the state's congressional districts favoring Republicans. They'd be based on 2020 census data, like the current maps. Those were drawn by Republicans in 2021 and maintained a 7-2 GOP majority, with Democrat Frank Mervin holding the first district in northwest Indiana, and Democrat Andre Carson holding the 7th district, which covers much of Indianapolis. Bray told reporters Tuesday that redrawn maps wouldn't guarantee an automatic 9 Republican Hoosier members of Congress. Bray says he wants to see Republicans maintain the U.S. House majority, but that he and the other GOP senators didn't favor redrawing the 2021 maps. I'm not sure that a number of members of our caucus, at least I'm included in that number, don't feel like it's right to the right way to move forward simply because it's not the right way to get that goal achieved, Bray said. House Speaker Todd Huston said Tuesday that House Republicans have the necessary votes to address this issue, and we stand ready to get the job done. Huston adjourned the House until January 5th, but told members to remain prepared for a possible return during the first 2 weeks of December. My hope is that with our great colleagues in the Senate, we'll embrace this and then we'll all return in early December for a special session to pass new maps, Huston told reporters. This has been a fluid situation for a while, and it'll continue to be fluid, I'm sure. Despite Indiana being among Trump's targets for congressional redistricting since August, Huston maintains that Republicans have settled on a new map plan, or have not settled on a new map plan, rather. We haven't gotten that far, he said. Had some conversations, we haven't gotten that far. Trump has used social media in recent days to rebuke Bray and other Republican senators who don't support redistricting. Trump did so again Tuesday with a post that said Braun must produce on redistricting. Quote, I won Indiana in a landslide, the most votes ever gotten in the state. Such an honor, a Rhino State Senator Roderick Bray, who doesn't care about keeping the majority in the House in D.C., is the primary problem, Trump's post said. One senator seemingly switched his position on redistricting. Senator Jim Tomes, a Republican from Wadesville, had been counted as a no for weeks, but clarified on the Senate floor Tuesday that when push comes to shove, he would vote yes in support of Trump. Senator Travis Holdman, Republican of Markle, came out in opposition on Tuesday. The message from my district has been clear. They do not support mid-cycle redistricting, and therefore I cannot support it, Holdman said in a statement. The current standing among the 40 Republican senators who have publicly stated a position on redistricting is 15 in favor and 10 against. Several other Senate Republicans declined to state their position, with some wanting to see a proposed map first. Braun sat alongside Huston and Bray during an unrelated event a couple of hours ahead of the afternoon floor sessions. Neither of the legislative leaders nor the governor spoke to the few dozen people attending the pro-redistricting rally feet away, which drew redistricting advocates, Lieutenant Governor Micah Beckwith and Secretary of State Diego Morales. Braun suggested to reporters Tuesday morning that the House would advance a redistricting bill even without senators in the state house. The House is already publicly out there for it, anxious for them to get a bill out there that they send to the Senate, Braun said. Tuesday's Senate vote also divided Republican leaders there. Bray and Holdman, who holds the November 3rd leadership post as majority caucus chair, voted to adjourn until January, while Senate Majority Floor Leader Chris Garden, the second-ranking leader, voted against the resolution. Braun maintained that momentum was building in favor of Indiana going along with Trump's redistricting push. When that decision was made by Senator Bray, that's because it was so close, Braun said. With all the pressure, all the stuff that's going to come from here forward, this is just in the first inning, so we're going to see what happens.
Analysis: tax changes may limit growth. From Leslie Bonilla Munez from the Indiana Capital Chronicle. Recent changes to Indiana's property tax system will likely cut bills for most Hoosier homeowners, analysis has found. But owners of pricey houses are expected to get bigger breaks, while those with low-valued dwellings may pay more, according to an Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute report released Friday. Its author, Indiana tax expert Larry DeBoer, said that Governor Mike Braun's hallmark tax law may squash growth and assess value statewide through 2031, when key changes take full effect. Chief among them is the homestead standard deduction, which Senate-enrolled Act 1 phases out by 2031. The fixed deduction lops $48,000 off the taxable value of a primary residence. If you've got a $500,000 house, you've got a $500,000 house. $48,000 is nothing, DeBoer said. If you've got an $80,000 house, $48,000 is very significant. DeBoer, an emeritus agricultural economics professor at Purdue University, presented his results Friday at the Indiana Farm Bureau's headquarters in Indianapolis. The supplemental deduction, however, will raise its current 37.5% to 66.7% by 2031. Because it's a percentage, homeowners will save less on cheap homes than pricey ones. The break-even point, at which the two policies yield the same taxable value, is a home worth $102,740, per DeBoer. He estimated the average in Indiana to be $234,500. Counties with high homestead values, particularly Boone and Hamilton, will take harder hits to their tax bases, he said. If the Senate-enrolled Act No. 1 restricts assessed value growth but levies the total tax governments can collect, rise tax rates will also creep higher. DeBoer calculated that most property will hit the property tax caps at a rate of $3 per $100 in assessed value. Homestead property owners get a circuit breaker credit on the amount of property taxes over 1% of assessed value. Many primary residences will likely reach the caps by 2031, according to the analysis. Property tax bills for those houses will be higher than now, but lower than they would have been without the law. DeBoer joked that when Hoosiers complained bills went up, local officials can reply, "Ah, that we not changed the policy, it would have gone up even more, and the taxpayer will be satisfied." Rueful laughter, right? DeBoer said. Under his projections, it really is a tax reduction for the average homeowner, but the average homeowner is not going to believe it. But for those not at the caps, pricey homes are expected to carry smaller increases in their bills, or even slight drops. Low-value homes could see a double-digit percentage hike, per the report. Also beginning in 2026, a new supplemental tax credit will apply after the caps, taking off 10% or up to $300. Property types that hit the caps at 2% of assessed value get new breaks under Senate-enrolled Act No. 1, the first deduction that these folks have ever really gotten, DeBoer said. Non-homestead residential, like apartment buildings or vacation houses, falls under that category. So does farmland. The new deduction phases into 33.4% by 2031. DeBoer estimated that if gross assessed value for the non-homestead residential rises 5% annually through 2031, the net assessed value would fall each year over that time period. Farmland net assessed value is also projected to fall most years, and under DeBoer's estimates, the net would be 33.4 lower in 2031 than it is in 2025. Senate-enrolled Act 1 also raises the business personal property exemption from $80,000 to $2 million. DeBoer said that will impact small and medium-sized firms more, since larger ones with more property will continue paying as before. Counties with a high share of business property, personal taxes, will see lower losses from the exemption, like rural counties hosting large electric utility installations, according to the analysis. The law also ditches a 30% floor on those property assessments after 2025. DeBoer predicted little effect in the short term, higher assessed values in the medium term, and lower assessed values in the long run. Once business personal property bought before 2026 has been retired. But there could be loopholes. One attendee asked, what happens if when a company purchases $2 million worth of equipment, it does so under a new entity? One of the goals of the property tax policies is to create a neutral system that does not influence business decision-making, DeBoer replied to with laughter. And I suspect they've created something that could. Obviously, the big ones aren't going to be able to divide themselves up into little $2 million segments, but a medium-sized business, one could imagine it, manage it, he continued. Accountants and lawyers are going to earn their money. Business real property gets no new deductions. Taxes in SEA 1 are shifting to big businesses with lots of personal property and to rural homeowners with very low value homes, DeBoer said. It's an interesting policy mix. Indiana Capital Chronicle is part of State's Newsroom, a nonprofit news network supported by grants and a coalition of dollars as a 501c3 public charity. Indiana Capital Chronicle maintains editorial independence. Contact editor Nikki Kelly for questions.
Okay, and I'll be reading some local news briefs for Fort Wayne and Allen County. Nitric acid spill near downtown under control in about 3 hours. The Fort Wayne Fire Department was called to Webb Chemical Service Corp., 702 Hayden Street, about 1 p.m. Tuesday for a nitric acid spill outside the building near downtown. Webb Chemical personnel and the Fort Wayne Fire Hazardous Response Team were able to contain the industrial chemical spill to the company's property, according to a fire department news release. Fort Wayne Water Pollution assisted at the scene to ensure the local water supply wasn't affected. The Fort Wayne Police Department set up a 300-foot perimeter around the property. Cell phones within a half mile of the site received a message instructing people to shelter in place for the next 1 or 2 hours, the release said. The incident was brought under control in about 3 hours. An investigation is ongoing, the release said. Lynx chapter to run free childhood literacy program. The Fort Wayne chapter of the Lynx Incorporated will launch a free early childhood literacy program from 3 to 4 p.m. Saturday at the Pontiac branch of the Allen County Public Library. The program Books, Beats, and Brushes includes a book club and is open to all youth in pre-K to third grade. It will focus on reading, rhythm, and art for joyful learning. The goal is to help youth improve reading fluency and comprehension, encourage family participating in reading at home, connecting literacy with rhythm, art and wellness, while building pride in the African American culture and heritage. This is no cost to participate, but parents and caregivers will be asked to register their youth during the orientation launch from 3 to 4 p.m. Saturday. The program will then meet on designated Thursdays and Saturdays through April. It will include story time with music and movement and creative art opportunities based on inspiration from books being read. More details and specific dates will be provided at the orientation. Each child registered in the program will receive a literacy kit that includes a book with a culturally relevant story by an African American author or illustrator of or theme, and a mini lesson that focuses on health literacy. And then finally, a holiday memorial service set for Baker Street Station. The 40th annual holiday memorial service and tree lighting will begin at 5 p.m. Sunday at the Baker Street train station, 221 West Baker Street in downtown Fort Wayne. This annual event, which is sponsored by Stillwater Hospice, features guest speakers, a performance by the Fort Wayne Children's Choir, and the symbolic lighting of an evergreen tree with twinkling lights memorializing and honoring those who've passed on. Families donating in memory of loved ones to the service help support Stillwater Hospice, a nonprofit that cares for individuals facing serious illness, regardless of ability to pay for services. Stillwater's grief support team cares for families after a loved one has passed, and events such as this honor the memories of those who have gone before. Learn more about Stillwater Hospice by going online to stillwater-hospice.org. And let's see, apologize. That concludes the news for the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette for November 19th, 2025. We will now take a short break and return with obituaries and features from the living section.